This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman. We are 1 week away from President Trump's scheduled summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Our next guest suggested a number of months ago that Vietnam would be a good place for a meeting, and that's just where the two leaders are set to talk. Retired Lieutenant General Dan Leaf has been Deputy Commander of U.S. Pacific Command and has also served as Director of the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies. Aloha, General. Thanks for joining us again.
Aloha, Bill. My pleasure.
You know, in the eyes of some, that first meeting between these two leaders was a success simply really because it happened. It was back in June 2018. Now things get a little more complicated. And what, in your view, do we need to see to have this meeting be judged a success?
I think it boils down to a single, simple, but elusive word, and that's progress. Progress that both sides can cite. So for North Korea, that means progress in its emergence, if you will, into the community of nations. And for the United States, it means progress on denuclearization, the end goal for all interaction between the U.S. and the DPRK.
But the metrics on judging that progress have to still be seemingly a little soft at this point.
Well, they are soft, and I think the two sides view the denuclearization metrics differently. North Korea likes to talk about denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, and the U.S. likes to talk in various ways of describing it about complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization. Those aren't the same thing. They don't see them as the same thing. But the truth of the matter is we've already made progress to reducing tensions. We need to continue that progress, and I think the U.S. has to have a very long view about getting to that end game, that complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization. Find a way to get some substantial, if you will, progress that they can legitimately cite, that the government can legitimately cite as real progress.
But again, that's over time, so there's no imminent pressure really on this meeting in terms of specific metrics to come up with, say.
Well, I think there will be, certainly in the media and in political circles, you know, we do like instant gratification in the United States, and there will be some who cite it as a failure if there isn't a comprehensive agreement on denuclearization out of this second summit, but that's not a realistic goal, and any progress is important, and we just need to keep that long-term strategic target in mind.
Now, they're going to be meeting in Vietnam, which you suggested, as I mentioned, would be a good venue. We know that's within range of Kim Jong-un's private plane, but what else makes that a good location?
Well, it is convenient, and that's not a small matter. There has to be some place that Kim can get to relatively easily. Vietnam has a lot of other logistical advantages. It's a controlled, orderly society where they can have the meeting in a secure environment with enough but not too much attention from the outside world. It's a place that's comfortable to both. Comfortable to the U.S. because of the strategic relationship that's been formed over decades of hard work, and it's comfortable to the DPRK, to North Korea, because it's a communist country and never truly an ally, but certainly a country that they're comfortable dealing with. I think there's a more important psychological element of that that goes beyond U.S.-North Korea matters, and that's the exemplar that the U.S.-Vietnam relationship provides as a place where post-war reconciliation has actually worked. You know, there are many unresolved conflicts, some of them a century or more old, in Asia and elsewhere, where people simply can't get over it. The United States and Vietnam have formed a partnership that brings value to both nations and to the region, and it's been formed by hard work, and by a little bit of give and take, a lot of understanding, and a sense that the future is, in fact, more important than the past.
You know, you mentioned that progress, and certainly that's the case, but Vietnam is also not a place where human rights are a particularly strong feature. Criticism of the Communist Party, for example, just is not tolerated. Market economy is engaged, but certainly practices like freedom of the press are not. Is that a complicating factor?
I think it's a complementary, not complicating factor, because the United States, throughout this process of reconciliation, is continually but thoughtfully pressed Vietnam on their human rights practices. So we haven't given them a pass, and they haven't completely acquiesced to what the United States would like to see in terms of international norms and human rights. So it's a give and take that is imperfect but respectful on both sides, and it should, to North Korea, provide an example that the United States is not as heavy-handed as we are sometimes portrayed in pressing our interests, our desires, not as heavy-handed as we're portrayed, and certainly not as heavy-handed as some other countries that'll remain nameless.
Well, when we get past the Vietnam summit itself, in the past we've spoken about U.S.-South Korean military exercises, their importance.
Mm-hmm.
Springtime is the usual time frame for the full Eagle exercises. Last year's came before the Singapore summit and involved more than 11,000 U.S. personnel, nearly 300,000 South Korean forces, land, sea, air. How important is it, in your view, that these go ahead in some form, and is it okay if they're on a smaller scale?
Well, let's go back to the Singapore summit when there was the surprise announcement of the suspension of joint military exercises, even though in pursuing the summit, Kim Jong-un had suggested that he understood why those exercises had to be held. So we had that surprise announcement. I think it would be unfortunate if there were another suspension or a long-term cancellation of such exercises, not so much for military readiness. The South Korean military is very, very capable. The partnership between the U.S. and the Republic of Korea has been formed and honed over decades, and North Korea cannot win a war over South Korea or over the Korean Peninsula. Cannot win. Now, can they create a bunch of a really horrible level of destruction and death? Absolutely. They cannot win. So it's not as much about readiness to counter North Korean aggression as about a signal that the alliance is still strong, that that part of maximum pressure, of military preparedness to counter any North Korean military action, is still there, still important, and both the U.S. and the Republic of Korea are committed to it. That signal has to remain, because that has to be part of Kim's calculus. That, let's see, I can't win this, and I've blown the treasury on pursuing weapon and missile capability, so I have to be more accommodating and engage in discussions and negotiations with the U.S.
You know, that touches on one other aspect of all of this, too, which is international expectations. So going into this, again, for, say China and Japan, two international perspectives very different, but both very important to this process. How do you see those?
Well, they're very different. They have different interests that are kind of small and finite and not very strategic in claiming victory of their interests were advanced. You know, China has said that there are certain things on denuclearization that they wouldn't support, and Japan has a issue with abductees and other things. And, you know, so the eaches of what might come out of the summit on the progress towards denuclearization and other related issues like abductees will be of interest to China and Japan. But what's really of interest to those two countries, to all countries, is to avoiding conflict on the Korean Peninsula. And so if I were on the negotiating team, and I'm not, but if I were, I'd try to keep my eye on the ball and recognize that long-term peace on the Korean Peninsula, with its broader positive effect throughout Asia, is the objective. That's the objective during the pursuit of denuclearization of North Korea.
And given that objective, what would you say that listeners should be watching for when it comes to this summit?
If both sides declare success, I'm going to oversimplify it and say we're good. If both sides can claim success, then we're making progress. And the details of how they define success and what they cite as examples of the success that has been achieved are not as important as a sense that we're still moving forward.
We'll be watching for that forward progress. Retired Lieutenant General Dan Leaf spent a career in the Air Force and served as Deputy Commander of the U.S. Pacific Command, as well as Director of the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies here in Honolulu. He's currently the Managing Director of Phase Minus One LLC. General, thanks for sharing your thoughts.
My pleasure, Bill. Take care.
You too. This is the conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. On a day when the world may be a little too much in your face, you might consider a trip to the quiet of the Hawaii State Art Museum. It's currently located on the second floor at No. 1 Capitol District Building. The Spanish Mission-style inspired architecture allows you to instantly immerse yourself in the craftsmanship of the time that it was built. Three galleries make up the museum. They show temporary exhibits and a permanent collection of Hawaiian art. However, art has not always occupied the halls of this serene building. Back in the day, the building's clientele was more on the combatant side. For today's quiz, can you trace the history of the State Art Museum building back to its purpose during the First World War? And for extra credit, can you name the original intent of the building before the war? Call 941-3689. Or 877-941-3689. If you know the answer, first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Alfrey Woodard from Turnaround Arts Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Last week's arrest of Philippines journalist Maria Ressa by the government of President Rodrigo Duterte shocked many. She was recently named as one of Time magazine's Persons of the Year for her efforts to maintain an independent voice for news in the Philippines by way of the news website she founded, Rappler.com. A newly organized group in Hawaii is rallying to support free speech for her and for other journalists in the Philippines. Catherine Cruz spoke with R.C. Amasa and Ellen Ray Cachola about what they see as human rights violations in the Philippines. We hear first from R.C. Amasa.
So we are the Hawaii Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines. It is a network of individuals and organizations in Hawaii. We are concerned about the worsening human rights situation in the Philippines, and we are committed to working to raise awareness on the ongoing human rights situation in the Philippines. Our members come from different professions in the community. Currently, we are all based in Oahu. Last year, we got together and formed this committee in our efforts to respond to the recent killing of attorney Benjamin Ramos. Attorney Ramos is a human rights defender based in Negros, Philippines, and was a people's lawyer. At the time, he was shot in front of a small store in a community by an unidentified gunman. There were strong indications that the government of Duterte had to do with his killing because of his political work at that time and his work as a lawyer for the sugarcane workers, peasants in the community. Anyway, so our committee got together in November last year. We formed our group in solidarity with the other human rights groups and individuals around the world condemning the worsening human rights situation in the Philippines under the Duterte government.
We just had this development with Maria Ressa, the journalist, who was the person of the year, and her arrest came down. What was the reaction in the community?
We were completely shocked, but also feeling that this situation is a continuation of ongoing traumatic information coming from the Philippines. So we also know that she was speaking out against the Duterte regime, and he was trying to get her organization for various tax evasion, and this time it's cyber libel issues. And so all of the background past information about Duterte's tactics around human rights violations, and then with her being arrested, we already felt like there's some kind of framing going on because of there's this longstanding problem. So I feel that it's time to speak out and to be very vocal about this situation. It's scary, and it's time for the people of Hawaii to pay attention and to try to find a way to do something about this.
Now, I've talked to folks in the community who have family in the Philippines, and they go back to visit, and they'll come back with stories about what's happening in their village. Do you folks have any firsthand experience?
Yeah, actually, I myself am a migrant. My family moved to Hawaii in 2007. My parents and my siblings did. I come from a family of farmers in the northern Luzon of the Philippines. And I had a lot of friends who were actively involved in actions, actively working for not just human rights, but a lot of socioeconomic issues. And it's difficult not to be in opposition to the government policies because it's so obvious that the government is not really serving the interests of the people, especially the working people and the farmers in the communities. And So I met a lot of people who are opposed, who became activists. 2 years ago when I went back to Philippines, like, I got in touch again with my friends and then get to spend time with them. But months after I came back to Hawaii, I heard the news that one of my friends who was a human rights defender, she's very young, but she was one of those who were massacred by the military, and it was very obvious that it was the military agents who did it. They were ambushed, a group of young activists who were trying to get into a peasant community to do more investigations into the ongoing human rights violations themselves. So
were they driving to the village?
Right, they were going into the village when they were ambushed.
And so, Ellen, what about you?
The experiences that I have, there's two experiences. We have a colleague of ours that recently went to the Philippines for these international human rights exposure trips, and she was from New York, and she went with a group to go back. And she stayed with indigenous communities in Mindanao, with the Lumad communities, and learning about their alternative schools where they're trying to grow their own plants for food security, educate their children about their indigenous culture, because a lot of them are discriminated in the lowland schools in the lower parts of the Philippines because there's an indigenous kind of discrimination. And so she really learned a lot about them, about these communities practicing self-determination and learning to empower themselves through culture. And so that was an example of human rights resilience and activism. But when she came back to the United States, come back to Hawaii and stayed here for a couple more months, she learned that the people she stayed with, the three leaders from that community, were killed by paramilitary. So she was devastated, and she actually sparked this campaign with Decolonia Pinay, which is a community group that I'm also part of that precedes High Chirp. And she educated us about this increasing militarization in Mindanao because they wanted the Lumad community's land for mining purposes and logging purposes. So that really started to spread the word here at the local level here.
So you think we're going to see more expressions of, I don't know, defiance or just rallying against what's going on in the Philippines?
Yeah, that's something that our committee, our group, is trying to work for, because right now there are estimated 27,000 victims to the Duterte's drug war. So these are common individuals that are just, you know, just walking by, and then suddenly they get shot by the police, and then the police would just say they're drug addicts or they're selling drugs, or, you know, so there's
case closed.
Right. Yeah. So I feel like there's a lot of us out there that have connections, like deep connections. There are friends and relatives that are victims to the ongoing drug war of the Duterte.
You folks came out in support of a statement that was released by Senator Brian Schatz.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yes, we did. And we applaud him for standing up against the recent arrest of Maria Ressa, because he is Hawaii senator and he sits on Appropriations Committee in Congress. And he was involved in a lot of the U.S. Funding aid to the Philippines, and which has went to the military, Philippine military. He's also funding military infrastructure building here in Hawaii, too. So it was really great and awesome that he's finally stood up against this arrest, because, you know, what is this military or this funding from U.S. to aid? What is it doing, you know, to these countries? And Maria Ressa is just one symptom of this broader problem that U.S. military funding has been doing in the region, and specifically Philippines. That, you know, I think this is an opening for communities to speak out, because we have a leader who is speaking out, and it gives us courage. We need to start talking as a community about the situation in a different way, to talk about why we're so dependent on military funding and economies. What are other things that we can fund our military funds to, such as education or healthcare? You know, these kinds of like bold questions that I think there are people in the U.S. Congress that are shaping that direction. And I really want us to start, like, you know, thinking in that positive way, because there's so much negativity and trauma that is has so much psychological effect on our communities.
What do you think the reaction is going to be from the community here? Because I know lots of folks, I think, have ties to the Locos Norte, which is where Marcos was from. So how does that work with Duterte and the community here?
There is a pro-Duterte perspective out here. And, you know, I think it's because of a certain lack of information about other ethnic and communities in the Philippines and how they are experiencing the situation. And then when you have a break in freedom of the press, like how we've seen with Maria, the communication isn't going, the education isn't happening. And I think, so High Chirp is really staunch in our focus of talking about what's going on in the Philippines from the perspective of indigenous people, the working farmers and the professionals, the advocates and the poor people that have experienced this political situation, and to highlight that, because I think it gets marginalized. And so we don't really, I think that there are those critical pro-Duterte views, but we want to have a different light so that we can shape the public discourse, so we can truly understand from a clear perspective what's going on. So all of us have the responsibility to make an ethical decision on, you know, make our own decision based on the diversity of perspectives.
A coalition of human rights groups is planning a day of action in Washington, D.C. sometime in April. You just heard from Ellen Ray Cachola and Arcia Masa about human rights issues in the Philippines and the recent arrest of journalist Maria Ressa, founder of the online news site Rappler.com, who's now out on bail, by the way. Cachola is a lecturer at the University of Hawaii Ethnic Studies Department. Masa is a new doctor, a graduate of the UH School of Medicine. Next week, we hope to bring you an interview with Maria Ressa herself.
Tax refunds seem like a huge income bump, but really, you're just getting back what the government owes you interest-free.
Refunds aren't cool, right? Like, that's your money. They're making this seem that a refund is something magical.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the non-magic of the tax refund, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
Public disclosure of police disciplinary records has been an ongoing issue in Hawaii. In the latest development, a court's ruled that an arbitrator's report in a sensitive case must be released to the public. Our partners at Civil Beat intervened in this case. Editor and General Manager Patty Epler joins us this morning with an update. And Patty, this involved a Honolulu police sergeant who was fired for repeatedly punching his girlfriend in a Waipahu restaurant and then was reinstated with back pay by an arbitrator 4 years later. And now that report from the arbitrator is going to be released?
Well, we hope it could be released. The police union very likely will appeal, so who knows how long it will take for us to actually see the document. But the judge, Judge Crabtree, was very strong in his support for the public being able to see exactly what the arbitrator decided. We haven't been able to see it yet. The city and the police department, it's been a year or so now, said we'll release this report, and then SHOPO, the police union, stepped in and filed a lawsuit. So no one's even been able to tell us what was in the report, what the arbitrator was thinking, that kind of thing.
Interesting in terms of Judge Crabtree's decision. He said the report is a matter of significant public interest and also said that the more serious the misconduct, the more likely the public interest outweighs the individual privacy interest. And that's the line of argument that you've been making for quite some time in terms of Civil Beat.
Yes. You know, we started this back in probably 2013 with a series on police misconduct, looking at the sort of summary information that the public was able to access, but there were no details. So the police union has always argued that it's not fair to the officers because a lot of the misconduct is things like they didn't shine their shoes properly or they came to work without a buttoned on their shirt. But if you look at just even the vague summaries we get, it's really, really serious stuff, you know, criminal offenses, leaving the scene of a hit and run without, you know, reporting it where the officer was the one who caused the hit and run, domestic violence, I mean, lots of assaults. So serious stuff. And I think that's really what Judge Crabtree was getting at, was that some of this stuff really is serious. Like, as everyone probably knows by now who watches the news, this Sergeant Darren Cachola was videotaped at this restaurant punching his girlfriend throughout the restaurant. And yet he was, and when the police department tried to fire him or did fire him, an arbitrator stepped in at the union's request and said, nope, he gets his job back and all that back pay, years of back pay.
And it's interesting, again, Judge Crabtree's notes talking about significant public interest also in knowing how HPD supervises alleged misconduct, responds to misconduct allegations, and investigates alleged misconduct.
Yes, you know, that, Bill, that is a really key point because that's one of the things that we've always tried to figure out with the limited information that's been available, which is if you can't know what officer is being disciplined or for what necessarily, how do you know it's not the same person over and over again getting disciplined, and why is HPD allowing that to happen? Or, you know, there's just so many things that go not only to the misconduct itself, but also how police officials are handling the cases. Are they fair? One guy gets a one-day suspension for the same thing that another guy gets discharged for. Like, what's up, you know, with that?
We will keep an eye on the next developments in this case. Thanks very much, Patty Epler.
Thank you, Bill, for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat, today featuring editor and general manager Patty Epler. To read the full story, you can visit civilbeat.org. Pedestrian safety remains an issue of high interest in the islands. On Oahu, we're going to be hearing more on that topic later today from Mayor Kirk Caldwell, who's having a news conference on possible new initiatives. Following our show last month on pedestrian safety, listeners shared different ideas, starting with Hunter, a Texas transplant living on Maui.
I moved here 5 years ago, and in Austin, the police have come up with lots of creative ways to indicate crosswalks, including balloons like they use at car dealerships, as well as the blow-up Gumbies that dance around. And these things shoot up out of the ground when the crosswalk is going to be occupied. And these things all are surface-mounted. No trenching involved. They attach from curb to curb, and they're like a speed table, but more mild. And then they jump up and stop traffic.
Aloha, my name is Andrea, and I have two proposals. One is traffic lights where there is only a pedestrian crosswalk and not an intersection. Or low-tech solution like they do in Hilo, yellow flag in buckets at both ends of the street.
Another topic that really resonated with listeners was our program leading up to the anniversary of the January 13th false missile alert.
Hi, my name's Kathy. I'm calling from Maui. On Maui, the sirens never went off. Those are tested every month. So then I believed the cell phone alarm was a scam call, and I was not worried. I have compassion for whichever employee or employees were responsible for the cell phone alarm, because given the political climate, we were all on edge for a nuclear attack. Alerting the public was heroic, quite frankly, and I'd much rather be safe than sorry. Regarding North Korea's inability to aim well, that's no comfort. If they don't hit Honolulu, maybe they'll get Kauai or Molokai. Depending on which way the wind is blowing, the weeks of nuclear fallout would be a slow death for us. We have nowhere to go. And I will continue to believe we are in the best, most caring, efficient hands as we depend upon our state and counties of Hawaii to protect us the best they can. Mahalo.
Hi, this is Paul from Aina Aina. I was very disappointed in the discussion on the false missile alert. First, it seems to me that there have been no structural changes inside of Haima or throughout the chain through the TAG or to the governor that have addressed the significant problems that, as I see, to rectify what I would consider not only training throughout the range of problems, but the end of that discussion, it seemed to me like I was watching a self-licking ice cream cone that will eventually melt. We're only talking about the natural disaster and those sorts of issues on the Haima side. We also have a significant problem with cybersecurity and with anti-terrorism issues, law enforcement issues, that's under the purview of the Homeland Security Agency, which both work for the TAG. Thank you.
We appreciate your feedback. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach us via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or you can call our TalkBack line and leave your comments at 792-8217.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll catch up with Mana Up, the small business accelerator that helps take local Hawaii brands to the next level. Mana Up has just announced their third cohort of companies, and we'll have a couple of them on to learn about their game plan for success. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
Hawaii may be losing out on millions of dollars in corporate tax revenue. A report from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy found that $38 million in revenue could be generated by closing a loophole that allows multinational corporations to avoid paying Hawaii state taxes. Beth Giesting is the executive director of the Hawaii Budget and Policy Center. She spoke with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about how business is taxed in Hawaii and how multinationals avoid it.
The state corporate tax rate varies depending on the amount of income of the corporation. The upper tax rate, I believe, is 6.4%. And this is on corporate income, which is business income that isn't otherwise subject to the general excise tax.
And how about at the federal level?
At the federal level, there is a series of corporate income taxes there. The federal tax reform that was passed December 2017 reduced the corporate tax rates, and the theory was that corporations that were working internationally or otherwise hiding income from the federal government were going to be incentivized to bring their corporate revenues home and pay taxes on them. I don't think it exactly worked out that way, and in fact, the tax reform from 2017 did nothing to encourage corporations to repatriate corporate earnings to the United States. In fact, in some ways, had the opposite effect. That creates a problem at the state level, for some states anyway, because many states just follow the federal tax laws. It is certainly easier for taxpayers to have a standardized way of paying taxes, and so many states just adopt wholesale federal tax changes. Hawaii doesn't do that entirely. We do have some differences from the federal tax law, and we could be different when it comes to taxing multinational corporations as well. I think that it's important for us to all recognize that businesses that operate in Hawaii get benefits from the infrastructure and services that are provided publicly here. And so all of our local corporations and businesses pay their fair share of state taxes. Hawaii is one of 27 states and the District of Columbia that also have a mechanism to bring in our fair share of income from national corporations. Where we have not been able so far to bring in a fair share is for multinational corporations. And these corporations have managed typically to reduce their tax indebtedness on the national level. And if states follow the national tax code, then states are missing out on that too. We believe that there is an opportunity for the state of Hawaii to fairly simply bring in additional revenue from these multinational corporations, and the amount is pretty substantial. The estimate right now is $38 million year after year.
So what you're saying is that national corporations, so something incorporated in the United States versus a multinational, they're taxed differently.
Yes. So Hawaii has adopted a combined reporting system. And so in that, they are capturing information about the overall revenues that this corporation has for the entire country. And then Hawaii assesses its fair share of that for business that takes place in the state of Hawaii. So if a business works in a number of different states and 5% of its revenues or sales or whatever happen in Hawaii, then the state of Hawaii can tax that 5%.
And so what's missing with these multinational corporations that we're not able to capture that same type of revenue?
Well, it turns out that we are able to capture that, but we do need to change our tax code. So it appears to be a fairly simple fix. Multinational companies do already need to report to the IRS what their international income is. So Hawaii could put a provision into our tax code to require a multinational corporation operating in Hawaii to provide the same information that they provide to the IRS to us. And then Hawaii would have some latitude in deciding how much of it is a fair appropriation to attribute to Hawaii, and then whatever that that attributable amount is, they could assess our tax rate to the corporation, say 6.4%.
So basically, multinational corporations are not required to report their earnings to the state of Hawaii. They only report them to the U.S. government, and therefore the state of Hawaii isn't currently taxing that income.
That's correct. We currently are not receiving that information or levying a tax. We could change that, though, with our tax code.
Beth, I've heard it kind of theorized before or speculated that this loophole for large corporations, multinational in this case, gives them a competitive advantage over a small corporation that can't avoid taxes. Is there any truth to that idea?
Oh, absolutely. If a corporation is managing to avoid paying taxes, in this case 6.4% of Hawaii corporate taxes, they will have that much more that they get to invest and work with, as opposed to those law-abiding local corporations or even national corporations that are being subject to state taxes. So they have a tremendous incentive and advantage in avoiding paying taxes.
That was Beth Giesting, Executive Director of the Hawaii Budget and Policy Center. The state legislature is currently exploring tax bills relating to real estate trusts and carbon emissions, but not closing that multinational loophole she mentioned. If you want to read the report on that provision of the tax, we'll have a link to it posted with this story on hawaiipublicradio.org.
In Australia, they aren't building a wall to keep asylum seekers out. Instead, they're shipping them to a small island in the South Pacific.
I can see lots of fences and rocks. Like, everywhere you walk, there's rocks.
Many of the children are falling into a deep depression.
She's sick. She doesn't like to eat. She doesn't like to see anyone.
Australia's refugee crisis on the next Reveal.
This evening at 7.
For today's backyard quiz, we asked you to trace the lineage of the State Art Museum building. And here's the story. While they were both in the cabinet under King Kamehameha V, American politicians John Mott Smith and Charles Coffin Harris convinced the legislature to fund a hotel. It did, and the hotel opened in 1872. In 1917, it was converted to a YMCA and subsequently commandeered by the military in World War I. But time and termites did a lot of damage, and in 1926, the structure was razed. The building you see today, designed in the Spanish Mission style, is home to guests, both permanent and temporary. It's where you can find the State Art Museum. That is today's quiz, and we had a winner, a quick response from Roger in Volcano over in the Big Island, and he knew because he had offices there when he worked for the YMCA. If you've got a backyard quiz, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.com. At the top of the program, we promised you some details about being on the road with art in South Kona. HPR's arts and culture reporter Noe Tanigawa is here with a closer look at that and a bit of a creative ramble on the west side of the Big Island, eh?
Sounds like a good idea to me, yeah. Bill. You know, combine them both for a big West Hawaii Art Weekend, yeah. And it's coming up. South Kona Artists Collective, they call themselves SOKO, S-O-K-O. This is their fifth annual art tour they have coming up this Saturday and Sunday from 9 o'clock until 4 in the afternoon. And it's kind of like a road rally. Mm. You know, you just go on through, you have your map, and the whole thing started with just the artists around there just kind of getting to know each other and becoming friends. And then they all have been living there a while. And one photographer there, Kathleen Carr, was really instrumental in getting the Sonoma County Art Trails tour going over there. And they have 150 artists participating on their big weekend, two weekends it's expanded to in the fall. So she decided, hey, let's get this thing going in Kona. So they got the SOKO tour going. And after 5 years, Kathleen Carr says they're starting to get some attention.
Well, we've been having great sales and interest, and it definitely expands the exposure for each individual artist to be part of a collective. we get inspired by each other, and we've formed quite a bond.
Can you make any generalizations about what South Kona does to artists?
Well, we have a two-lane highway in South Kona, and the pace is a little slower, and it's rural, so there's a lot of nature, and the ocean is right there. Just an inspiring, gorgeous place with enough time to really enjoy it because, the pace is a little slower here.
Can you imagine, Bill?
Two-lane highway, huh? That's, it's funny. I was checking out on their on SoCo's website there, and this is a wide variety of artists.
You
You've
are
got
so right.
Everybody from painters to woodworkers, quilters, sculptors, photographers.
Fabric, I know, and I love it because the area they're covering is basically from Ho'okena down on the south side to about Holualoa up above. And the big, like you're saying, there's a Malia Barrera's float does henna art. Kind of Hindu iconography thing, drawing henna art on your hands. Yeah. Linda Purcell Satchel, she's got oils and pastels, and she does some of that Ipu gourd art carving and staining thing. Kathleen Carr's got her photography studio there in Captain Cook, along with some of their painters, ceramic artists up there. And then there are a couple of groups right above Kealakekua Bay, which is kind of neat. Gigi Goodney does jewelry there at Big Island Bees. So, they combine what they're doing. Catherine Wynn does some quilting and fiber art up there, too. And then if you just keep going, north, the last group is up by Holualoa. And that includes Joseph Hadley. He's a writer. Brother Joe used to live here in Manoa for a long, long time. He does kind of contemporary tribal art using, distressed wood. And it was fun to find these little spoons and forks and plates that were handmade out of pewter. Willem Martin is a pewtersmith on this tour.
Well, what's wonderful is that it gives exposure to the many artists who actually live down here in South Kona. Otherwise, we don't have a general place to display our work. A lot of the people involved in this are gardeners. We love the land here. People have chickens. They raise produce. Quite a number of them actually raise coffee. And that's one of the reasons they're in South Kona. It's a kind of a tour of the area as well as of our studios because people get to see, Kealakekua Bay and all kinds of things they might not have seen. It's good exposure for us and for our little part of the world.
It really is. I mean, this is one art tour you can head out with your snorkel, your mask, and your swimming gear because the best place to start is going to be Honaunau, City of Refuge.
Yes, and great place to wander around there as
Has
well.
Has it been a while since you've been there, Bill?
It's actually just end of last year.
Really?
I was there with visitors from Japan, actually. And that, the history of that whole area as well, touched on it in terms of the coffee, but the early settlements of Japanese particularly settling and growing coffee and really growing that area. Pretty fascinating story. In addition to the art and the artists along the way, it's really a very historic area on a lot of fronts, and of course back in Native Hawaiian pre-contact time as well, as you mentioned.
I haven't been to Honaunau since they since we were at like 7 million visitors.
Oh, jeez.
There could be 3 million more. I don't know what it's like. But the last time we went, we just snorkeled around in the bay there and, did little hermit crab races. And one time I was there, there was someone picking vana, and tossing them into a burlap bag and they could shake them up. And it was just, it's still a great part of the island, that whole South Kona area. Again, the SoCo Artist Tour is Saturday and Sunday from 9 to 4. But, if you're heading on the northward track there, Holualoa is the home of Donkey Mill Art Center. And they're having their big annual auction this year as well. It's not going there on there in Holualoa at the Art Center. It's going on down at the BMW of Hawaii headquarters there in Kailua Kona.
Uh-huh.
And this art auction is a major chance to get some great nationally, internationally known, and Hawaii artists in one place, let me tell you. And they've got Esther Shimazu there. Some terrific work by their artist in residence recently, Andrea Desso, an incredible carving artist, works in many different fields. Satoru Abe, Wayne Levin, of course, Hiroki Morinoue, also represented in the auction that's coming up there, the Donkey Mill Art Center auction at BMW. That's on Saturday. I think that starts from about 5 o'clock, 5 or 6.
Wow,
so check
real
on that
opportunity
one.
Weekend coming in terms of art on the road.
Art on the road on the west side of Big Island. Sounds really fun.
Yeah, and also I know on their website they have not only a map, they've even got a Google map. that you can make use of.
They have done a great job setting this up, and I think some other islands can take a look at their format and think,
All right, good idea and well set. Noe Tanigawa, you know her. She covers arts, culture, ideas for Hawaii Public Radio. You can find her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org. You go to the News and Talk pull-down menu. You click on that. You find Arts and Culture. You go into it. You find all kinds of Noe stories. That is the conversation for today. Up tomorrow, we take a closer look at a Clean Water Act case that's being taken up by the U.S. Supreme Court. You can tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number to call, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or Twitter at HI Conversation. The show and all our past ones are available at the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Catherine Cruz back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.